Tēnā koutou katoa and hello everybody. Welcome to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. My name is Ben Adelberg and I'm coming to you from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. Tēnei ka mihi ke te mana whenua o Aotearoa. And we acknowledge the local tribal authorities of New Zealand.
And g'day, I'm Emma Strutt. I'm currently coming to you from Darrumbull country in Queensland. Before we dive into our conversation today, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. Finally, if you enjoy this poddy, please subscribe, comment, like or share on our social media and consider buying us a coffee if you'd like to help support our work. Now on with the show.
There are a few things we've learned over the years doing this podcast, and one of those being the wonderful Dr. Jen Lavers of Adrift Lab, a past guest herself, works with so many amazing people and has been a fantastic source for podcast guests. And this episode is certainly no exception.
That's right. So today we are chatting with Dr. Neil Hadaway, a photojournalist and environmental photographer whose work highlights the damaging impacts of capitalism and unchecked economic growth. Neil actually has a PhD in environmental science and made his switch to photography after a 20-year career in environmental research. Neil has a fascinating background and a number of current projects that we can't wait to talk to him about. So let's jump right in. Neil, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Neil, as Emma mentioned, a fascinating background. So before we get stuck into the actual conversation, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you got to have that deep, not only interest, but care for environmental sciences.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always had this real sense of obligation to protect the natural world. My parents always remind me of when I was a kid in a swimming pool, plucking out all the insects and wasps and trying to save them. But I've always been interested in that. And that was why I got into environmental science, really, was to have a career in protecting the environment. And also really been motivated and inspired by the wildlife documentaries that I guess our generation grew up with. That really inspired me to want to be in these beautiful places and saving them for future generations. And I guess somewhere along the way, I sort of forgot a little bit about that desire to be really involved in the sort of physical protection of things and got a bit caught up in the academia. But I think that's something that's always been a driving force for me, is to try and preserve what we have left.
You've had quite an illustrious career as an environmental researcher. I mean, you were senior research fellow at Stockholm Environmental Institute. You have an outstanding H index. You provide training courses for Cochrane, you know, like really well established and acknowledged and as an expert in your field. And I know you haven't given absolutely everything away to make that shift into photography and photojournalism. But after 20 years, that's a huge leap and I'd imagine a little nerve-wracking. So why the change? Why the motivation behind this pivot to photography?
Yeah, it was a big change. I was thinking about this before. There are so many reasons and so many nudges that pushed me into that change. I think there are a few that I'd want to mention. One of them was the academic pressure of being in an institute, being in an academic institute that sort of really emphasizes publications and all of those very challenging metrics that we're meant to achieve, like bringing in grants and supporting other colleagues with funding. And it just made me lose sight of why I was doing it a bit, really. In combination with that, I mean, I started my career working in conservation science. My PhD was on conservation of crayfish in the UK. And after that, I moved into desk-based research, so science policy stuff, summarizing literature for use in science policy. And I think taking that sort of overview of all of the primary literature, condensing it in a way that is digestible and can be used, and then seeing it not being used is kind of heartbreaking. And I moved from conservation into environmental science, into agriculture and greenhouse gases, and then into climate change. For me, it was when I was living climate change in my job, and I was living it in my social life. It was all I could think about in the context of a really difficult time in my life. It just became too much. So I wanted to reconnect with that desire to inspire people visually, that I, in a way that I was inspired as a kid watching wildlife documentaries. So that was sort of the context. Something had to change. And actually at the time I was just thinking, I need to get out of academia. I just want to do photography because I enjoy it. I worked for a really brief time as a wedding photographer and absolutely hated it, but loved the photography side. So I was thinking, I'm just going to do photography and I'll find a master's, because that's how you get good at something, right? You just do a master's in it. So that was my plan. And then actually over the last 2 years or so, as I was developing my portfolio for the master's and then through the master's, the reconnection with the earth and the planet and wanting to preserve things, but also point out like really insane stuff that just shouldn't be existing anymore. I wanted to use the visual language tools that I was learning to bring those to the fore, really. So I've sort of merged back into that environmental academia world. And I'm actually just about to start a job which blends the two. I'm doing a research job at university looking at the use of photography in introducing agricultural research in the media. So I guess I'm a bit like an addict. I can't get away from it.
Now, you're certainly not the first person we've spoken to. In fact, our very last guest, Max Romy, is a filmmaker, artist, but you're not the first person that uses some form of art, whether it be photography, sketching, filmmaking, etc., to communicate science. And the common thread has always been the importance of having a different medium to use to communicate science. You're in a little bit of a unique space because you're not just an artist of some form, and your medium is photography, but you are a scientist. So you've just mentioned the ability to merge the two. How important is that in terms of reaching a broader audience and engaging the audience in a different way by using photography?
That's a really good point. It is really important to me because I worked with some really amazing researchers at the Stockholm Environment Institute who introduced me to the concept of storytelling and what that really means. I was really lucky enough to work with groups working with indigenous issues in northern Sweden in a project which opened my eyes to the power of storytelling as well. But this is a concept that, as a scientist, I remember getting peer review back on a paper that I was editing a special series, and this one paper was talking about storytelling, and the editor was like, I don't really like that word. Doesn't it mean anecdote? And you think like scientists just sort of, sometimes some scientists are a little bit allergic to that concept of storytelling. And for me, that experience really opened my eyes to what one of my colleagues introduced to me, Aristotle's three modes of persuasion, to get really nerdy with you. There's logos, which is logic, there's ethos, which is ethics and authority, and there's pathos, which is emotion. And good stories have all three. And I think in science, we have got a little bit lost in amongst the weeds of logos. We think that the authority that's been given to us through our education and through the position of science as an independent force is enough to then combine with logic. All people need is information. It's the information deficit model, right? All people need is good information, and then they'll make the right choices. And branches of science do well in admitting that that's not quite the case. But pathos, this emotion, the emotional connection to your reader, to your listener, to your audience, has sort of been lost deliberately for the preservation of authority. You can't show emotion, you can't talk about emotion, because you have this this sort of position of authority. And my colleague Joe Duggan, who's done a series called Is This How You Feel, which got climate scientists to talk about their feelings in handwritten letters, really highlights this importance of emotion to to connect with someone who's telling you something. But yeah, good storytelling has to have all of those three cornerstones. And you see the far right, you see extremists using pathos really well and sort of having false logic. But science, I think, has been really slow to embrace that. And it's been slow to realize the importance of connecting with the public. I spent the summer, last summer, living in an off-grid community in Portugal. And there, you know, some people have some conspiracy theories that they sort of hold on to, but they're all wanting to preserve the planet. But it was really interesting for me to be seeing the sources of information that they get, which was YouTube, and, you know, these really compelling stories that were being told online. And I think science just hasn't caught up to that. I think we still think we're just talking to politicians and to industry and to people who make decisions. And so that connection of the important science behind the story with something that's really emotive and moving is what is really motivating for me.
You raise such a valid point, because I think, Emma, correct me if I'm wrong, was it Thomas Tottrell? A couple of seasons ago, he spoke about, when he was doing his PhD research, there's a concept he taught us, and it's called a Kapati approach. And it's indigenous, Aboriginal Creole for a cup of tea. And the whole concept is about sitting down and talking and telling stories, because exactly like you say, a typical researcher, a typical scientist goes in with, there's a list. These are my objectives. These are the outcomes I need. There's already a predetermined path. Everything's blinkered. We're not, you know, this is the path we need to take. This is the way we're going to do it. I need answers now. Whereas the way the indigenous approach is exactly as you say, the storytelling. And we acknowledge now, and we realize now, very late in the Western world, how much importance indigenous learnings play in terms of not only understanding the past, but actually the best way forward. So you touch on such a key aspect that we've been so focused on the logic. There's a system, there's approach, there's a structure, but we forget the ethos, the sort of the ethics and the emotive part to it as well. So it's just so, you know, we've learned this from this part of the world, but you know, you're learning this from a very complete opposite end of the world, the same concept, the same lesson, just in a different way.
And yeah, that's a really good point. I think these storytelling techniques have been around for tens of thousands of years. They're the most important thing that's contributed to the expansion of human culture. And, you know, it's ironic that science is rediscovering them, whereas, you know, 20 years ago, it was treating them with real contempt. But another thing I think I'd say, just to your point about art, is this this point about building a salient message. So a message that sticks with someone. And to do that, you not only need it to be an emotional message that they can connect with, but you can also make use of the viewer's journey whilst looking at your story. So a scientist, we want to be like, A is B and B is C, so A equals C. And you tell them the whole story. And people are like, okay. But salience is all about saying, you know, you build the logic, A is B and B is C, and then you let the person make the jump from A to C. And that then sticks in their head because they've made that logical jump themselves. They've created that understanding and the knowledge themselves. So I think that's what's beautiful about real art. And that, you know, art is about starting conversations. It's not necessarily about finishing them. So I think there's a lot that scientists can learn from that too.
You'll be coming to our little corner of the world later in the year to work with the wonderful Adrift Lab team and to do a feature on eco-grief. But this is something you've also co-authored science on, so dealing with emotions as a climate scientist. I mean, just reading the data as a consumer, the literature is confronting enough. So to be on the front lines of this, it must surely take a mental toll. And I know we've just been talking about science being quite logic-based, and I suppose it can be easy to gloss over the fact that there's real humans with real emotions behind that science at the coalface. So what do you see as some of the mental health risks associated with climate and environmental research?
Yeah, Yeah, I did a project a few years ago called Hope and How to Grieve the Planet, where I was really confronted with this. And actually, my justification for wanting to do that project was because I felt I was the only one who was struggling to think, you know, is research worth it? What are we here for? Are we having an impact? Is it, are we going to actually be able to do anything? Feeling very hopeless. Mentioned it to a couple of colleagues and they felt the same. And I realized, you know, there's this untold story of, I mean, in the same way that Joe has done his project, I wasn't aware of, is this how you feel at the time, the Letters Project. But I felt people needed to know that scientists are struggling too. And also that amongst scientists, we just don't talk about our feelings. I think there's this acknowledgement that you shouldn't admit that you don't know what you're doing is impactful, or you shouldn't talk about feelings at work. Maybe that's universal. But I started to talk to my colleagues, and then people put me in touch with other people. And I spoke to about 25 people, interviewed them for about 2 hours, photographing them. They brought three emotions that they felt about the state of the planet. And we discussed each one in turn, and then they helped to pick one portrait for each of those words. And it was very, very hard. We had lots of very difficult discussions. I cried a lot. One time we had to pause and just sit on the sofa for an hour while we sobbed. But everybody used the word catharsis unprompted. And so I think it highlights that, you know, people who are working in environmental topics and climate science, we're faced with not only seeing this stuff, we know in minute detail what's coming, but also we've built these walls to separate ourselves from our own emotions often. And so that tidal wave of emotions has nowhere to go. One of the people I spoke to said she would spend hours standing in the supermarket trying to make decisions between plastics, local, you know, the carbon footprint, the social footprint of the food that she was buying, and would then buy the wrong thing, go home and cry. And that was just, people wouldn't go shopping with her. So, you know, these emotions are seeping out of our work and into our daily life. They're already in everyone's daily lives, really. But that that pain of knowing what's coming is quite unique to people in this situation, not just academics, but people who work in the environmental field or who really familiarize themselves with the research. So a couple of people talked to me about burnout, of being close to not being able to cope. I've been through that myself on a very related topic. So I think we do face a building crisis in terms of the mental health impacts of observing what we're observing. I think in a way at the moment, it's that environmental research is at the front lines of that. But I think that is going to spill into the general public as we become more aware and see with our own eyes. We get that solastalgia. We get the observing changes in our own backyards. I think it will spread out. So if researchers can act as sentinels and we can build solutions to help them deal with that whilst not losing efficacy in what they're doing, if that's what they want to do in their daily lives and their research lives, then I think that can be a positive thing that comes out of it. But yeah, I think we're heading for a bit of a problem.
You know, with most professions, you can be a doctor, you can be it doesn't matter what you are, you leave your place of work and you can do something that's completely incongruent to what you normally do, and that's your release, right? It's you're not faced with it. The uniqueness with environmental, climate, related science, research, etc., is you leave your place of work and you're still surrounded by it. You know, mm-hmm. You're surrounded by it's constantly around you. In that example of going shopping and trying to make this constant decision, because do you think there's also that element of pressure of, with that profession, you will be judged if you're also not practicing what you preach? You're telling people to change their habits. We've had this conversation with other guests about being an imperfect environmentalist. You know, it's this pressure of being perfect. And if you mm-hmm. can't, it's just too hard. But you're going to be judged because, hey, you're writing papers and you're telling all of us to change, but I saw you do this or I saw you do that. You're a hypocrite. now why should I listen to you? Do you think there's also that extra layer of you're constantly being watched?
Yeah, 100%. And if you look at the words that people brought to the Hope Project, guilty is one of the most common. It's really tough. I mean, you mentioned I'm traveling from North Wales to Australia in April, and that's a decision that I was invited by Jen and Alex to go and photograph them and their emotional struggle with microplastics or plastics and the impacts on seabirds at Lord Howe Island. And I've really struggled with that decision of whether to fly. It's 3 tons of carbon. Surely there's got to be a better photographer in the region who could do it. I try really hard to minimize my carbon. I'm a vegan. I don't travel otherwise. I don't have kids, although not by choice. But, I do try. And then to do something that's so wholly blowing my carbon into the stratosphere in terms of impacts, it is a really difficult decision, and it's one that I'm not okay with. I think people really do struggle because it's so difficult to be perfect. And it's in your daily life. Everything is in your daily life. So everything has an impact. So the best way to not have an impact is just to stay at home, turn your heating off and stop eating. And some of the people I've spoken to have gone to the real extreme where they're, and I would say I have to some degree as well, what's the best way of really minimizing my impact on the planet? And you think, well, there's one way. And these conversations that I've had with people get into the really deep stuff that that is very depressing. And this is just things that they think about every day. This is the stuff that they have in the back of their mind constantly. And some people square that really well. Some people I have spoken to have a strong system of logic about all of their decisions, and they sit with that quite well. But what that tends to do is then alienate them from other people. And, we saw this with a pandemic that government tells you to have this system of logic about what you do and where you go and what's okay and what's not okay. And then you start to see people not doing that and you question it. And then the government changes its advice. And so, we've got our own internal moral compass that we're learning about and we're building. And the stories that I'm doing outside of climate, looking at the impacts of greenhouse agriculture in southern Spain for our all year round fruit and vegetables that essentially causes modern slavery, that you try to be perfect and then you find out something you didn't know before and you can't have avocados anymore or quinoa. Or so I think the one thing that's made me feel a bit better about this is that it's not our fault, it's the system that they've designed and that they've let happen for the wealth of a very small elite. And so I think having that sort of awareness that we are not to blame, even though we are causing some of these impacts, is one of the only ways to have hope, really. But that guilt is, it's every second of every day for me.
So how do climate scientists best deal with the emotional distress that comes hand in hand with their work then? I mean, are there any particularly effective treatment models of care or therapy, or is this truly just an under-researched area and you just got to struggle through at the moment?
I think, one of the good things that is around is that there are systems that are pretty similar, like people working in humanitarian aid, particularly what we're seeing in the Middle East at the moment. People who are observing those firsthand have had systems of support built up around them, and they probably have built their own ways of dealing with it. So there are resources on hand that we can tap into, that we can learn from. Although, as you say, it's a bit of a unique case. The most important thing is just to talk about it, just to break this taboo of not talking about our emotions. And so talking about it with colleagues, and often it is colleagues because friends might not understand, friends and family who don't know what we know. But I've just done some research. I worked again with Joe Duggan and documentary film makers in Sweden who've they did a film about group therapy for environmental scientists, and they got seven environmental scientists in the US who were strangers to meet for a 2-day group therapy session to see, does it work? What do they talk about? And we were approached before the therapy session to ask if we would analyze the transcripts. So we did a grounded theory light analysis of these transcripts, just trying to pull out what were the themes that people talk about. Did they find that it was a safe space? Was it effective? Yeah. And on the whole, there were some really interesting things that were discussed, particularly about academic pressures and their intersectionality with other issues like race and gender, and how that then intersected with the knowledge of climate change and how they support their students who they're teaching about climate change. But we think it showed that group therapy is really an effective way, which I think is just reinforcing this just talk about it concept, really, that acknowledging that you feel guilty or that you feel hopeless is okay. The title of one of our early papers was, it's okay to feel the way that you do, it's okay to feel that way. And that's something that I think underscores my approach to this research and this type of photography, that I want to just make people feel it's okay to feel like they do.
Where do you think universities, academic institutes, what's their role in ensuring that, you know, group therapy or the necessary support is actually there for their workers? Because you've mentioned before, you know, there's a huge pressure to publish. We know around the world that research funding is tightening. It's hard to even get your research funded, let alone make space for the extra support that's needed to do the research. So what's their role? What's their ethical imperative to actually step up to the plate and help here?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good point. In their words, they have a duty of care. And I think this is particularly the case for teaching institutions, where the people who are feeling these emotions as researchers are going to then be teaching vulnerable people, students of a younger age. I think supporting them to support their students as well as supporting their students is a vital thing that I think even universities would agree is important. I don't think from this group therapy analysis that we did, there is an awareness that those lecturers, those researchers need support in supporting their students. So I think that duty of care boundary needs expanding a little bit. But I've had a, let's say, discussion with a previous head of one of the organizations I worked with who claimed he didn't think he had a duty of care to support his researchers who are working with environmental topics. And I just don't think that's acceptable. I think if your job involves learning about the impacts of the environment or teaching other people about the impacts of us on the environment, whether it's microplastics, whether it's climate, whether it's biodiversity crisis, PFAS, these forever chemicals, you know, people who are learning more about that are doing it on the job. Their employer has a duty of care to look after them. So, you know, it's in everybody's interest if they're given the support that they need to carry on doing what they're doing and not just burn out and get replaced. So I think that very much depends on the institutional culture. And if you have an institution that does care about maintaining people's mental health, then hopefully that will happen. If the resources aren't there, then they should be. But I think if you have an institution that views human resources as human resources, then I think that can be a challenge. And then the other thing I would say is that the unions, when they're there, have this power to hold organizations to account. And I think if unions can pivot to, which many of them are, to being aware of that impact of environmental knowledge on people's well-being, particularly with teaching that stuff to young people, then, you know, I think unions stand a good chance as being that pivot point to put pressure on organizations to do that well.
So we're talking about a duty of care within tertiary institutions. What about the rest? What about the rest of us? What about the rest of the population? More specifically, has eco-grief amongst Indigenous communities been explored?
I do remember seeing something recently that was saying that climate anxiety is a Western concept. That, you know, that was a theory that it's the ability to identify that as a syndrome comes from a place of privilege. I don't really know how I feel about that. I think there are so many other things that people have to deal with when they are not privileged. You know, I was reading a book called Solastalgia that's edited by Paul Bogard, I think it is, Paul Bogard. It's a series of 34 essays that are written about the concept of solastalgia, this feeling of homesickness in your own home. And one of them, I forget who it was by a First Nations North American researcher who, paraphrasing probably very poorly, was basically saying that they have been facing their own end of days for thousands of years at the hand of colonizers. And so that this feeling of impending climate doom is a different feeling to them. And so I think it's really important, as always with everything, to acknowledge the diversity of differences in how people experience the impacts of the environment, that just because they've been feeling it for hundreds or thousands of years doesn't mean it's any less acute, but it might mean that it needs processing in a different way. It might mean that they have incredible insights to be telling us. It might be that, you know, we don't have the right to those insights if they're, you know, we can't force people to tell us what helps them get by if we've been responsible for their colonization. So I think there are, I mean, I'm the last person to have any expertise on Indigenous rights, but I think it is a different lens. The one thing I think I would say is there is a tendency in the West to pathologize climate anxiety and eco grief, so to view it as a disease and to try to treat it. And I think what needs to be done in these situations is stop oil expansion, to stop carbon emissions, and to stop wars, to stop funding things that kill our planet and kill our people. So, like, great, let's make people feel better if they're struggling, but let's find the root cause and solve them. And in most cases, that is providing equity, that is removing barriers to underrepresented and minority groups, and it is trying to give, you know, the same opportunities to everybody and to remove the ultra wealthy. So I think, yeah, it for me, it's all about those fundamental issues and everything else will follow. But that's not to say that they don't need immediate attention.
Do you think we'll be able to manage that under the economic system that we currently adhere to?
No. No, because, I mean, I could talk for hours about my opinions about our current economic and political and social system, but it's designed to make a very small group of people very, very wealthy, irrespective of the cost. I mean, you just have to see that my government, the UK government, is currently bombing the poorest nation on earth for carrying out a peaceful blockade to try and stop a genocide. So we'd rather preserve our Amazon deliveries than stop tens of thousands of children being murdered. And so I think so much of what we're seeing is the result of a system that's been designed to make people really wealthy. And what we're seeing is that system has worked really well. It's squeezed all the wealth out to a few very, very rich white men. And this is what happens when the world starts to wake up and realize that that is the source of virtually all of our problems. So no, I don't think we can solve the world's crises at all in our current economic system. I think they are the cause of everything.
I have heard you, which I was pleasantly surprised, not surprised, sorry. I was happy to hear, because it's a growing concept that still not enough people are on board in terms of understanding what it's all about, but degrowth, the degrowth movement, the degrowth concept, and so on. And that's really what you're alluding to now, is because degrowth, amongst a whole lot of other things, also addresses equity, but it certainly helps. Does it bring hope? It brings a better chance to minimize the damage that we're currently trajecting ourselves through.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it really does bring hope. It's one of the only things that brings me personally hope, because I am continually reminded that the things that I see, the conditions that I saw people living in the informal settlements in Almeria in southern Spain, who were producing the tomatoes and cucumbers and peppers at, you know, like a tenth of the price that they are then sold in supermarkets, and all of that profit is going to supermarkets. That system is so entirely broken that there's a really brief story I want to tell, actually. It's called The Salmon and the Tomato. And this story starts in Scotland, where salmon are farmed. And to produce those salmon, we need to fish for what's called fish meal. That fish meal is caught off the coast of West Africa in massive trawlers, which the EU has agreed can happen. It's the hegemony of the EU over developing states in Africa, the control of those states. EU trawlers are able to fish in those seas. They overfish. There's nothing left. We get our salmon. Great. What that does is the people in West Africa, Senegal is a particular example, can no longer fish. So they have no income. They have no way to feed themselves. The men from those families most often then are forced to travel. They travel to Europe, which is a source of finance they can then send home to support their families. They get to Europe. Some of them go to Spain because the Spanish authorities are a little bit more lax, because a lot of their economic systems depend on informal, undocumented labor. Some of them end up working in the tourist industry, waiting in restaurants, serving fish, illegally fished in their waters to tourists. But some of them end up working in the greenhouse agriculture in southern Spain. This is all the result of, you know, it's in academic papers that I can put links to. But some of these people end up working in greenhouses, essentially under slave labor, because they can't go home. Their home governments won't support them being repatriated without financial support. They have no long-term stability in their job. They're not given a contract. They work at well below minimum wage. They live in informal settlements without running water, without sanitation. And they are supporting the production of primarily tomatoes in Almeria. There's 3.5 million tons of fruit and vegetables that are produced year round because of these plastic greenhouses that are covered in so much cling film that every couple of years it breaks down. It has to be replaced every year. There's 33,000 tons of plastic that then has to be destroyed. Most of it ends up in the sea. They're extracting too much water from the ground because there isn't enough rain. So their groundwater is polluted, which they can't drink. They produce these tomatoes that are then exported to have along with our salmon. So this system is, it's a cycle, and it's all because they want to make profit. It's all because, you know, the system is designed to squeeze profit up to the top. And so I think it's really, going back to the point about guilt, you can't exit that system. You're in the system. You can't not feel guilty because there's nothing else you can do. That's the only things that are available for us to buy. You can avoid buying salmon, but then you buy tomatoes. So it's a wicked system.
For our listeners, Neil's kind of insight into Almeria and the production of food there, this is something you have documented yourself. We'll put a link in the show notes as well. So it's not just a story. It's well documented, and it's actually, I don't know, there's a whole lot of emotive words I can now start bringing out in terms of how I felt when I saw that, amongst a lot of the other projects. And one of the ones I do want to touch on, because it does touch on a few other conversations that we've had with other guests, and that's it's titled Coal Scars, and it's your sort of documentation of the coal mining, but it's open mining in Germany. Mm-hmm. the first image I saw at the top of the page already, wow, this is not, it's almost like our dairy industry here, cattle industry, mining in Australia. It's what you don't see. It's out of sight, out of mind. But those images tell a very telling story. Tell us a little bit about that. I know we're digressing a little bit, but it sort of links in with a lot of conversations we've had.
It does. Yeah. This is an indication of how I spend my holidays. I spent my holidays this summer partly flying my drone around the lignite mines in North Rhine-Westphalia in Western Germany around Cologne. And these mines are tens of miles wide and about 500 meters deep in some places. So I'm mixing my imperial and metric measures there, sorry. But these mines are the biggest thing that you'll ever see. They are enormous, enormous scars. You can see them from space. The lignite is a very dirty, wet version of coal. It's fossilized peat, so it's quite close to the surface. You don't need to dig a mine underground. You can just open the ground up, scrape it up. It's kind of mixed up with the soil. Burns really dirty because it's very wet. It's also very heavy, so you can't really transport it. It's very inefficient. So around these mines are just dozens of coal-fired power stations generating energy. It has a history of about 150 years, so that region has a long history of that kind of mining. And it's the coal is in horizontal layers under different layers of earth. So you get these layers of different colors of earth, yellows and browns, and then the blacks of the coal and gray of bits of coal mixed in with the dirt. So you get these what are really beautiful patterns in the dirt that they move out of the way. It's called overburden, that dirt that they don't want. And so it's sort of piled up in these quite beautiful, very abstract patterns. Seen from above, they're quite pretty, something you'd never see. But the scale of these enormous holes in the earth, where you can just see like half a dozen coal mines spewing out steam from their cooling towers with these massive holes. And the irony of, as these mines expand, they eat up farms, they eat up villages that will never come back. They just get translocated. Roads. So looking around from my drone, you can see motorways that just end. They're not there anymore. They've been diverted, so they go off at a right angle where it was that before they went straight through the middle of this area. And you also see wind turbines, because the energy company is greenwashing, so they put up some wind turbines, and then they have to take the wind turbines down because they want the coal from underneath them. That's actually happening. They're removing wind turbines so that they can mine the coal underneath. That is a shocking thing to have seen. And then learning about the fact that they want to end that by 2038, but the situation in Russia that and Russian invasion of Ukraine that then meant they didn't have access to Russian oil, and the after the Fukushima disaster they ramped up their denuclearization, if that's a word. They closed down all their nuclear power plants, so their energy system is often pitched as being quite instable, where actually it's not so unstable. They also produce a huge amount of wind, and they could produce a huge amount more. They have a load of solar, but they are using that language to justify the extension and expansion of coal mining in that region in 2024, when we're seeing what we thought would happen to the climate in 50 years happening already, and they are still expanding that coal expansion. So yeah, what you see is shocking, but what you know is even worse.
And this is in the midst, as you said, the greenwashing that comes out of Germany, because for the last few years they've been the big perfect example of how to decarbonize their energy system, and you know they sort of everything's going green, everything's sustainable, and yet this is, you know, they're literally still plowing on, excuse the pun. It's horrific. It's shocking. We won't go into every project you've been to, because this is it's just the stark reality. And just again, the you know, full circle, the importance of the storytelling through forms of photography, filmmaking, and so on. It's just an article, it's just words, these graphs, these pie charts, stats. Not everyone, you know, it's there's a lot of it. A photo tells a lot. And yeah. A photo does, well, a photo can lie now with AI, but in essence, a photo doesn't lie. That's you know, it's yeah, lost for words yeah, when I saw that.
It just sort of, I mean, the one thing that actually it struck me as soon as I put my drone up, the first thing I thought when I saw the scale of how deep, how huge, how much infrastructure there was in this hole was like, oh my God, if we can do that, imagine what we can do for good. Genuinely, like that was this really bizarre feeling where I was like, whoa, that's enormous. That's really cool. Humans can do that. And so that is, I mean, it's called what Edward Bertinsky refers to as the industrial sublime, this idea that you see something and you're like, wow. And it shows what we can do when you take the power and you put the power in the hands of people who want to do the right thing. The problem with situations like that is that the agency and the power to do the right thing is in the hands of the people who are doing the wrong thing. So they're giving with one hand and taking away, but there's hope in there. And so that's what I want to get across as well, that it's very easy to just go, oh my God, this is really bleak. Oh, this is really depressing. Oh, it's awful. Which yeah, some of my work does, I'm afraid, but I really want to give space for hope, because without hope, you know, it's just too much.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've talked about the countless complexities of trying to navigate through life in this episode. It kind of reminds me of The Good Place, if you've ever watched that show. but you bring us a truly unique perspective, because you've been both the scientist and the artist, and you've worked with a really broad range of people and groups. So, you know, when it comes to us, the everyday person advocating for climate or environmental or economic action and change, give us a little bit of hope here. How can we be more effective at what we're doing?
It's a really good point, really good question. And actually, I think it's really interesting for me, because over the last 12 months, I've seen a very, very rapid evolution where when people get asked this, they, rather than saying buy local, be careful about what you buy, which buys into this neoliberalist lie of consumerist power. What I've seen is a switch to people saying vote. And I do agree that voting is one of the most important things that we can do. What the switch for me over the last 3 months is that in the UK, who we can vote for is like that landscape of responsible parties to vote for is just eroding, as the party on the left over here is now well over on the right. But I think one of the most powerful things you can do is vote with your feet. So the end of this dying capitalist system that relies on exploitation of human and natural resources for the accumulation of wealth in the upper echelons, it relies on silence of the public. It relies on us being told to be apathetic, being trained to be apathetic. So getting out on the streets and protesting, in the UK, certainly in lots of other countries, there's lots of crackdowns on peaceful protest, but we are seeing that what has cracked down really tight in the UK is now being largely rejected in the courts. So I think we're seeing some pushback to that expansion of the police state in the UK and the judicial system. So I think I'd feel a little bit more comfortable telling people to do more peaceful protest now than I would have been about 6 months ago, when the risk from a policing perspective was higher. But I think just refusing to believe the narrative that that has been sold to us about capitalism, just learning what does degrowth mean. We've mentioned it, like I need to learn a lot more, buy a book about it, read about it, search Wikipedia, find out what capitalism means, find out what neoliberalism means, read Marx. These kind of things where like just being aware of a bit more, bringing that to a discussion with your friends and your family, starting a row at Christmas, those kind of things are what make you feel the worst often, because you're expanding your knowledge into something that is depressing and sad, but knowledge is power. And I think arming ourselves with this knowledge is what that's the armory we need around us. Those are the weapons we need around us in the coming decades to respond to people and say, no, that's a lie. No, that's not true. I think for me, it's knowledge.
What gives or who gives you hope?
That's a really good question, because I'm not sure I have a lot. I've worked quite closely with climate protesters over the last year. I've run a couple of projects with them, particularly a group of scientists who have been driven to peaceful protest, Scientist Rebellion and Scientists for Extinction Rebellion. And they are people who know what they're talking about. They're doing it because they know what's coming. And also, what they're doing is a huge sacrifice. Most of them have lost friends, they've lost families, they're risking their jobs, they're maybe being kicked out of their PhD. These aren't people who are like professional protesters. These are people who've taken that mantle on. And they have sacrificed so much. And if I think that's what brings me hope, is that the resourcefulness and the drive from them is far more than I have. I don't have it, and as a result I feel guilty, and I could be better, but I look to them to see what is possible. So I think I'm very much driven by the example that those people and the sacrifice that those people give, and then human ingenuity as well. I think.
Yeah.
We can do so much, but we've been told we can't.
A common question we have for a lot of our science communicators that we have on the show is the tongue-in-cheek question of, well, your job is to communicate science and you're supposedly good at it, but why does no one listen? And, you know, it's kind of tongue-in-cheek, but there's an element of truth to that, because there are so many brilliant people out there. You know, they're dedicated their lives to researching, to learning, to coming up with information that needs to be listened to. And yet, you know, you talk about your political system. We've just voted. Emma's just voted. Look at our governments. We've gone backwards. You know, it's we're not listening. And it's frustrating, because if not the scientists and the academics, then who else are we going to listen to?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And there's the refrain that came out of the pandemic, where like, we've had enough of experts. Someone in the UK government said that, which just haunts me. I think it's all related to, I'm going to sound a little bit like a conspiracy theorist now, but I think it's all related to information overload. It's a designed system of oppression. So in the early 20th century, mid 20th century, with the development of media, particularly late 20th century development of social media, there was this ability to have so much more information at our fingertips. And that was only marketed as a good thing and was never really questioned as a potentially bad thing. And it's been jumped on by systems of oppression to pacify us by giving us too much, so you fall into apathy. And I think this is again a point where science has not responded well enough, because we didn't see it coming. We didn't, you know, we were in the information deficit model. All people need is more information and they'll make better choices, and now that's very much not the case. There's too much information. We don't know what to trust. We don't know where to go. I think to some degree it's about the quality of information, where you put it, how you get it out there, and there are ways of making that better. But I think the first step is just being aware that making something and putting it out there isn't necessarily going to make a change, because someone can listen and it can go straight out their ear. The message has to be emotive. It has to be salient. I think there's a lot we can learn from the far right, actually, in the way that they tell messages, particularly places like the USA. I think science is on the back foot, and I think we need to change a little bit in the way that we communicate science. But yeah, I think it's also going to be really difficult to demonstrate that someone has listened, because there are so many other things that are going on now: cost of living crisis, destabilized governments, risk of people losing things, that these choices, you know, making choice about where you buy your salmon from, is it farmed or is it wild caught, or do you not have fish? Those choices are dropping down the priority scale. So just being aware of that shift in the environment of science information, and particularly how science is viewed after the pandemic, I think it's just something that we need to be aware of. But yeah, not a solution there.
Dr. Neil Hadaway, thank you so much for coming onto the show, but for all the amazing work that you do. The way that you do it, the way that you combine storytelling with science is unique. I think there's a huge opportunity there to really make people listen and create that awareness that you talk about. But like you say, art should and is only about starting those conversations. It's about the rest of us, the communities, to continue it and grow from this. So thank you so much for inspiring us. And we look forward to seeing the outcome with our friends at Drift Lab. We've interviewed a lot of them, Dr. Jen Lavers, Dr. Jack Orty, who's actually coming back on the show shortly, a lot of the PhD students. It's going to be a fascinating outcome, that one. So we look forward to seeing that and a lot of future work. So again, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's been such a privilege to be able to talk to you this morning. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. If you found this interesting, make sure you subscribe and share it with your friends.